I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Few could have imagined in 1969, at the time of the Stonewall riots, that same-sex marriage would be legal across the U.S. less than 50 years later. Before then, and for the 20 years that followed, the average American knew few, if any, gays or lesbians, and the issue of their civil rights never came up. At that time, the LGBT community itself was divided over whether the right to marry was even worth fighting for. In his latest book, Awakening, Nathaniel Frank tells the story of how an idea that once seemed unfathomable came to be a legal and moral right. Mr. Frank is a historian and internationally recognized authority on LGBTQ equality and the director of Columbia Law School's What We Know Project, a research initiative concerned with LGBTQ public policy. His book, which Kirk has called comprehensive and impressive in a starred review, is published by Harvard University Press. And after all that, I am pleased it brings Nathaniel Frank to the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
And congratulations on the book. This isn't your first.
It's my second. My first book was on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so I've moved to marriage.
That's right, which is a perfect progression because the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell came first and then this. But as I said in the introduction, things have changed so much in the last 50 years that many of our listeners may not remember. Now, didn't most gays and lesbians feel too afraid or even ashamed to come out publicly in the 60s and the 70s?
There were many reasons why people didn't come out and didn't share their stories, and it was a combination of feeling intimidated and fearful that they could lose their jobs, their livelihoods, their family relationships and friends. It was also, to some extent, the fact that people hadn't awakened to the idea that being gay or lesbian or bisexual, transgender eventually, were identities, actual identities that could bring people rights and that people with power could assert those rights. So that is something that had to be created and had to emerge, as with so many social movements before and after, and that's part of it.
Is it safe to say that folks viewed gayness, I'm just going to shrink it all,
right,
shrink it way down, gayness as rather than an identity, a behavior, in the sense that I have these feelings, but if I show them, I could get arrested, as you said, I could get arrested, I could lose my home, I could lose my job. That back in the day, I'm sure a lot of the folks listening don't even remember that gay men in particular had all sorts of signs and codes as a way of communicating to each other without speaking out loud, from handkerchiefs to hats to all sorts of things. What was it that, was there a spark that changed the gay community from thinking that they were not worthy to, wait a minute, this is who I am, and darn it, I want my city and my country to respect who I am.
Right, and as you said, the shift from the idea that gayness was something that people did to it being something that people were. So just as you said, in the early part of the 20th century, it was considered that same-sex desire, same-sex behavior was something that anybody could fall prey to. It was a moral weakness. It was a sin. It was religious. It was a crime. And it was something that everyone had to sort of battle against, particularly for those people who felt that desire strongly. And it had to be transformed around mid-century to an identity, to something that people felt, this is who I am, this is a natural desire, and it's a harmless desire. And I think there were a few reasons that that emerged. One was military service and the world wars that required a massive mobilization of men, mostly men, although not exclusively. And that brought men together in port cities and abroad in very intimate confines in ways that awakened people, in some senses, to the fact that they had these desires and that others did too. And so that was an important part, World War I, World War II, of what created a gay identity. Then there were these other social movements, the Black Civil Rights Movement, the feminist and women's movements, the student movements of mid-century, the 1960s, and gay people modeled their self-consciousness very directly on the idea of Black identity, the idea of female identity. And so in the 1960s, which was this period of social tumult and also new beginnings, there was a renewed sense and a new sense for many gay people that we are a people who have an identity, we have rights, and we deserve to assert those rights. And in that period, when so much was going on in terms of asserting rights, gay people joined in and developed their own sense of identity.
Yeah, their own sense of identity, but at a time when, and it still happens today, where there are large sections of the population in 2017, and most definitely back way back then, that being LGBTQ was a choice. There's still people who think that being gay is a choice. How was it possible to shift a big chunk of that thinking, even within the gay community, that this is not a choice?
Right. There is still a debate about that within the gay community. In some cases, women, lesbians are more inclined to see living a gay life, living with a person of the same sex, building a family around that, that is considered a choice. That's something you decide to do. But it's based on something that is very, very deeply rooted and that research shows essentially cannot be changed, whether it's, you know, hereditary or whether it's something that develops very early on. I think the way people came to understand that being gay or lesbian or bisexual is not a choice is by coming to know us. And so right. The importance of coming out, again, from the 1960s and on, when various gay leaders and gay people said, we have to be visible. We need to share our stories, lift our voices, and make people understand that this is, A, simply who we are, and we don't choose it, and B, it's a harmless way of being. It's mm-hmm. not something that, you know, there are so many myths circulating, and sometimes in many cases that were circulated by the religious right and other social conservatives, even liberals back in the day when, you know, before liberalism had sort of moved over to support LGBT equality, who were circulating these myths mm-hmm. that gay people were a threat. And so coming out and saying, this is who we are, you have to get to know us, was instrumental in helping people understand that this was a harmless identity.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and the person I just interrupted is Nathaniel Frank, who's written a new book, his second book, called Awakening: How Gays and Lesbians Brought Marriage Equality to America. And there are two things I want to get to before, and I just want to throw them out there so I don't forget. One is the issue of visibility, and then the issue of prioritization, because there are a lot of people in the gay community who are like, why are we going for marriage? But let's talk about visibility first. There are, and I want you to talk about this. I could say it, but I want you to talk about the two moments when the gay community felt compelled to be more visible. One, the Stonewall riots.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if you were asking.
It's like
specific.
Pop quiz. Right. The Stonewall riots, right. And then the AIDS crisis.
Right. So, you know, the Stonewall riots were in 1969, and they came toward the end of this period of social change. The Black Civil Rights Movement was very instrumental, and then the student movement, the anti-war movement, the feminist movement. So there was an enormous amount of excitement among young people. And in 1969, the police, who routinely raided gay bars because local laws forbid gay people from gathering together, encountered resistance, fairly spontaneous resistance across several nights in New York City at the Stonewall Inn. And it was this moment that sparked great visibility. There were important developments within gay rights in the 50s and 60s before Stonewall, which shouldn't be forgotten about. But this unleashed a new form of assertive activism and visibility that was in conjunction with the countercultural movements of young people at the time. And that meant that throughout the 1970s, you had a whole birth of new organizations, new ideas, some of which were very long-standing. Lambda Legal, right. Which became the main gay legal organization, and several others emerged afterwards. And this was the beginning of a long-term, sort of pragmatic way of organizing gay people within communities, especially in big cities, to advance their rights. And then the 1970s was sort of a period of gay liberation in the big cities in particular, and we can get back to that. But you also mentioned the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, which I want to
quick, is my history incorrect in thinking, was it a year after the Stonewall riots that the first gay pride parade happened in New York?
Right. The first gay pride parade was a marker of remembrance to honor that event in 1969. It was in 1970, and from there it became an annual event and spread to other cities.
Right. And so now the second big moment for LGBTQ visibility was the AIDS crisis.
Right. So in the 1980s, this illness that was first considered a gay cancer, that's before people knew exactly what it was and how it was transmitted, emerged early in the 1980s, particularly in big cities, New York City and San Francisco in particular, where there were large gay male populations. And the presence of AIDS when you had young people in their prime in these big cities who were used to being invulnerable and had just sort of hit their strides as a community in terms of visibility and asserting their rights and having found one another and you know, begun to really be able to form relationships and partnerships and the wider community, were suddenly devastated by the illness and death of thousands and then tens of thousands of disproportionately gay men, not exclusively.
A whole generation.
Right. A whole generation was devastated by this illness. And that, too, really sparked a new understanding of activism and a new form of activism. In particular, in the 70s, the earlier activism had been largely about the government should leave us alone. You know, we wanted privacy. We were challenging norms. We were challenging government authority. We wanted to be left alone to do what we wanted. And suddenly with AIDS, you need government recognition. Hmm. You need people to come and help this devastating public health crisis, which was largely ignored by the Reagan era and by authorities because of prejudice. And so new forms of activism had to be pioneered. It was a matter of life and death. And that involved recognition of gay people, recognition of the problem, and government activism to develop treatments. And eventually, you know, this laid the groundwork for asserting the importance of relationship recognition, which was going to be critical at this period.
I'm talking with Nathaniel Frank on the history of how marriage equality finally became a reality in America. I'm in Cape Art sitting in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Nathaniel Frank about his new book, Awakening, How Gays and Lesbians Brought Marriage Equality to America. And Nathaniel, it is incredible that marriage equality is the law of the land, especially when you consider, when you understand, when you know that within the LGBT community, going for marriage equality was a very controversial issue. Folks thought that that was the wrong fight to go for. Wasn't that the case?
Right. I think there's sometimes if you haven't been following this closely or haven't been in the trenches, you may have tuned in 2004 or 2008 when there were big mainstream headlines about it and thought, wow, marriage equality popped up so quickly. And, you know, the gay movement was united against, you know, in favor of this gay agenda and they got it done. Not so. If you go back in history a few decades, you find that the LGBT movement was enormously divided about whether to make something like marriage a priority. As with military service, parenting, family, the church, a lot of the mainstream institutions that eventually gay people were able to sort of capture as part of their own, were anathema to many of the earlier gay rights leaders and LGBT people. I think part of that is because so much LGBT activism came out of the countercultural movement,
right,
and the liberation era that we were discussing in the 1970s, where people just wanted to be left alone and didn't think that they needed to engage with these mainstream institutions. A lot of people felt that marriage was too bourgeois. It was oppressive. It was exclusionary for many lesbians. It was patriarchal. And the idea of embracing these rules of monogamy and legal limitations to what you could do just seemed like the opposite of the freedom and liberation mm-hmm. that they were wanting to push for. So there were ideological reasons that people had very different positions on this. Throughout the debate, there were also strategic differences mm-hmm. in terms of when and whether and how to go for marriage at various junctures.
Now, was there also a generational difference within the gay community over whether to go for marriage? Because to my mind, it was the folks who were like, why are we going for marriage and why do we want to do that were older gays and lesbians who are like, look, I don't want to, why are we doing this? Why do we want to go for, do be a part of this institution for all the reasons that you mentioned? But then I remember that the folks who seemed to be really pushing hard for it were younger gays and lesbians who, to my mind, wanted a family in the way that they either grew up with or they imagined or idolized in some way.
There were certainly generational differences, and that's reflected in differences in how people think about marriage and marriage equality, whether gay or not gay today, mm-hmm. in terms of how many people think, you know, young people today, gay or not, shrug and say, well, how could it ever have not been legal?
Right.
I mean, that's not the case across the board, but largely because of public opinion improvements, that is the case. But it's not a clean generational split. And one of the things that was somewhat surprising in my research and that might surprise readers of the book, even if they have been a part of this movement, is just how many different opinions there were for different reasons. I think there was sometimes a misunderstanding about who favored marriage and why, and there was an impression that LGBT people in general coming out of the 60s, 70s, and 80s didn't favor marriage. If you actually go back and look at some of the few polls that there were and talk to people and listen to a lot of sort of grassroots and outsider activists, even from the 70s and 80s and the 90s, there were plenty of people within the movement and outside the movement who actually said, we think we should be able to be married just as anyone else is. And so it's not a clean generational mm-hmm. split. There's a number of different reasons that different people would have favored it and wouldn't have. And I sort of go through the push and pull of the outsider activists and the institutional actors who were sometimes the more reluctant to go for marriage because of the activism they came for until that the movement in earnest really embraced marriage, around 2000, 2004.
I was about to ask,
and then there
when
was
did
a shift,
happen?
And that's a marked shift. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And was it the case in Massachusetts? Was it the win in Massachusetts at the court that made people, the community, shift to being in favor of making a strong push for marriage equality?
Certainly that was part of it. And so the community, LGBT community, LGBT people themselves, that's why I call the book Awakening, sort of had to awaken to their own dignity and their own need to have this public recognition, something that many had kind of eschewed before. There were people within the movement, Evan Wolfson, mm-hmm. Mary Bonato, legal thinkers in particular, and I go into a lot of detail about their ideas and their experiences, who had been pushing for this for quite a long
right.
time. There were other intellectuals like Andrew Sullivan on the conservative side who wrote about this starting in the late 1980s. And so there was a small handful of people who were pushing this early on, but it seemed so difficult to imagine. But once you started getting wins amidst the backlash, particularly in Massachusetts, which was the first state to legalize same-sex marriage in a state court decision mm-hmm. in 2003 that became effective in 2004, well, those victories breed more interest in getting on board, and that certainly was part of what got organizations like the Human Rights Campaign, who had been ambivalent, shall we say, about whether to embrace same-sex marriage as a top priority, on board to say, okay, this is something that's winnable, it's something that our community increasingly seems to want, and we can push for it. Even then, there continued to be divisions, both ideological and strategic.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of strategy, because as you're talking, I'm reminded that as momentum was building for marriage equality, so was the push, particularly after the election of President Obama, to do away with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I'm just wondering if during that time when these two things were happening at the same time, was there tension within the community about how hard to push on either for fear that pushing hard on Don't Ask, Don't Tell would hurt marriage equality, pushing hard on marriage equality would hurt the effort to do away with Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
There was certainly tension, not necessarily about should it be this issue or that. Now, there were organizations, if you're a Human Rights Campaign and you have to decide what are we going to prioritize in terms of our resources and in terms of our asks of legislators, then you have difficult choices to make. But for the most part, LGBT advocates, once they determined that as an ideological approach, these were things they wanted to push for, it was sort of all hands on deck. But what happened was that conservative backlash, which was there from the beginning, is one of the things that animated further pushes by gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual people, a lot of the people that I interviewed for the book and wrote about said, I didn't really care about these things, didn't care about the military, didn't care about marriage until the Republicans came out against it. You know, you started this whole marriage issue with a lawsuit in Hawaii in 1991, and eventually that led to a backlash where the Hawaii voters overturned a court decision that would have allowed it, and the Federal Defense of Marriage Act in 1996. And every presidential election year, conservatives seemed to drag out some sort of ballot initiative or some sort of initiative to roll back marriage rights, and that ended up galvanizing more and more people on the LGBT and liberal side to push for it. And so the push and pull was sort of along those lines, as well as being this long-term messaging campaign that said, if we go for military and marriage and family, even though for some people that's a little too bourgeois, these are going to be big wins because it's going to show people that this minority that had been confined to the margins for so long, that they belong at the center of society and that they're not the threat, the menacing sort of threat that people had said that they were.
You know, at what point did unbelievably, I just lost my train of thought.
That happens.
I know, it happens.
And there's so much here. It's enormously complicated tale.
There is so much here and so much history. And I think part of my problem is, even though I'm not a researcher, I lived all of this. And I'm wondering, I found my thought. I'm wondering, when people looked at, you know, if we get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and we bring about marriage equality, that this will be this cascade effect that a lot of people, including Michelangelo Signorelli and myself separately writing pieces saying, folks, you do realize that if and when we do get marriage equality, the battle's not over. How much of what the community has to face now, in addition to making sure that the T in LGBT is brought along in terms of equality and dignity, but that marriage isn't the end of the fight. That it's just it's the end of the beginning.
Right. It's absolutely critical. And, you know, I think a lot of us were concerned that once the big visible issues that may have a certain glamour attached to them, if you will, are one, that parts of the movement would pack up and go home. Now, there were organizations which said, like Freedom to Marry.
Right. Evan Wolfson's
said,
group.
Right. We are a single issue organization. And when we win, we're not going to hang around the way bureaucracies just float to exist and give ourselves jobs. We're going to pack up and go home. Hopefully, we'll use our assets and our lessons to do other good, which is what Evan and others on that staff are trying to do. But in general, you certainly lose a little when you make gains. That's always a part of what happens in the push and pull of activism. But I have to say that I've been heartened that so many people have continued in this fight. Obviously, the rise of Trump has created a new urgency for people to bring attention to the most vulnerable within our community and within other communities. But there was concern, for instance, with the military fight, where strategists, and I was among them, focused on gay, lesbian, bisexual ban in the military first, partly because it was a separate statute than the transgender ban, as a pragmatic step. And once we got that lifted, using the same arguments and the experience and lessons of that win, we came back and said, you know, now there's a transgender ban and it has the same mythology surrounding it as propped up the gay ban, and there's no rationale for that either. And we've gotten that lifted. It's the final implementation is scheduled for the next couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
In that regard, while you do have to remain vigilant and you have to make sure that resources continue to be devoted, especially in this under the Trump regime, I've been pleased that in some cases, you know, areas where I thought would lose attention have continued to focus on the needs of the most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you the question that I asked Cynthia Nixon a moment ago, and that is, are you worried about the gains that have been made for the LGBTQ community eroding under the Trump administration?
I think you have to be worried under the Trump administration about a whole range of things, and particularly those people who are the most vulnerable, again, among LGBT people, which means particularly transgender people, people of color, queer youth, and people in other communities, immigrants, Muslims, a whole list. But I also think that in part because of the pragmatic incremental strategy that LGBT advocates used to secure our gains, you know, a decades-long messaging strategy to win hearts and minds. I think in part for that reason, we have created gains that are more secure than other gains such as abortion rights in Roe v. Wade, which, you know, even Justice Ginsburg has said maybe happened sort of too quickly to have gained the hearts and minds behind it. So that's one of the lessons of this movement, is that when you get buy-in through hearts and minds over time, your gains are going to be more secure. In the meantime, you have to remain vigilant.
And I can't let you go without just asking you to reflect as a researcher and an historian, and particularly with your book, which is about the success of bringing about marriage equality to the country. Are you surprised by how relatively quickly all this came about?
I'm surprised by how quickly it came about at the end. But what I would emphasize, and what I emphasize in the book, is I go back to the 1950s, and I remind people, and I reminded myself, that this was a two-generations-long struggle. It's something that Evan Wolfson always talked about. You have to be relentlessly persistent, and it's not the case that this sort of happened between 2004 or 2008 and 2015. It happened over decades, and that's the way social change works. So things happened very quickly at the end, but it was built on decades of struggle within our movement and on the shoulders of other movements.
And so you're hopeful. Overall, you are optimistic about where the LGBTQ community is right now in America.
I have an optimistic personality, so I don't know if that part is based on research or based on my constitution, but I'll have to say yes.
Nathaniel Frank, thank you very much for being here. You are going to be discussing your new book, Awakening, How Gays and Lesbians Brought Marriage Equality to America, on Wednesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Book Culture on Columbus. That's at 450-450 Columbus Avenue between West 81st and 82nd Street. Thank you very much, Nathaniel, for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.